and welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce Vespa, your Sun Sounds of Arizona Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster. Today I'll be reading some more stories from My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat, Who Rescued Me by Caleb Carr, and if we have some time, I will be reading some newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to begin Chapter 23, The Wraith, with My Beloved Monster by Caleb Carr. In the last chapter, we learned that Caleb and Masha both experienced similar pains and similar fair-to-poor diagnoses. Both seemed to understand each other's pain, and they worked together to soothe each other. The signs that Masha was entering her seniority at about this time were less new tendencies than disappearance of old habits. I didn't catch them immediately because, again, her kitten face and her general air were still so young. She continued to carry herself with the same proud step, tail usually in the air, and eyes bright and wide and endlessly curious. But the step was slower, and when it came to the flights of stairs, she began to bunny hop down them, 2 feet at a time, and carefully, rather than taking them in full stride. Coming back up, she could still gather herself into a dash. Like almost every cat, she liked to run after using her box, for reasons both physical and psychological. The first was mere physical relief, the latter a desire to alleviate the anxiety that squatting and being vulnerable instilled. But she generally paid a price in leg spasms afterwards, and at those moments she went after her thighs, or one or both hind limbs, with her tongue and sometimes her teeth, licking and chewing in tight, quick little bites to try to loosen a muscle. I knew the feeling when cramps from my neuropathy hit. I sometimes beat on my legs to try to get them to loosen up, but usually to no effect. Then there were the sad ends of some little quirks that came in part because of Masha's age and decreased agility. In her younger years, for instance, I would sometimes find her drinking from one of the faucets. Cats are well known for preferring running water. Or drinking from the toilet, but not standing on the edge of that fixture with her forepaws and putting her neck and head down into it. Rather, she would stand inside the bowl with all 4 feet spread out above the waterline, then sip delicately from that seemingly impossible perch. In those days, when discovered, she could spontaneously launch herself out of the bowl without moistening her feet. Now she was delighted to find that if I filled one of the foot-soaking buckets I sometimes used to ice my own burning feet and calves with fresh water, the lip of the thing came up exactly to her chin. Having seen her drinking from one such before, I emptied it. I washed it out, filled it, and put it back on the floor for her. It became an easier and less painful source of drinking water, one that still reminded her of the toilet. I suppose because the water became straight from the well. I tried giving her bottled spring water, but she never trusted it. In addition, I could never tell if the association of these buckets with feet was somehow connected to her earlier obsession with socks. You just never know about some of her habits. And there was, finally, an end to recreational fighting. By spring of the year that the next book was to be published, Masha was at least 11, and more likely 12. She was learning to exert herself only when it was really necessary, and while it was true that I no longer presented any challenge to her in speed or agility, it was also true that she ended up sore and regretful after we took off after each other for even a few minutes. She accepted the change, I think, as neutral and natural, since similar restrictions began to affect her behavior outside, too. Sometimes I would catch her lying on a hot board of the porch on a warm day when the sun had passed its zenith and it was sending comforting beams in under the porch's roof, and she was holding her head up, looking at the birds on the lawn or at something even more interesting, with an expression that had gone past predatory. It was winsome, in a way, as if she knew that she no longer needed, wanted, or could afford to chase every living thing. There was still a great deal of gameness in the look. Without doubt, all and any creature had to do was cross a line, and she would still rally herself, no matter the cost. This was most true of her long feud with the gray squirrel that lived in the trunk of one of the big old maples that ringed the back porch. The tree was a codominant, with two equal-sized trunks rising from the main one, but it had lost one of the two stems to age during the time we'd been living in the house. Masha lay every afternoon in the southwest corner of the porch, perhaps deliberately, knowing that her mere presence was enough to make the squirrel close to insane with rage. Screaming for what seemed like hours from the closest branch of the maple, the squirrel would sometimes get to the ground, bound up the grassy bank, and poke his head around the column that stood by the porch steps on that side. Masha's head would pick right up even before the squirrel got that far, and when she sensed or saw his movements, she would get to her feet, knowing the squirrels were very tough game, but ready to discourage any kind of trespassing. I sometimes thought I heard, but never did see, actual tangling between them, and as it all went on, year after year, I wondered if they weren't really doing it as a ritual, the one of defense, the other of daring, and both having a certain amount of secret fun with it. Masha felt roughly the same way about the eastern Phoebes that loved to sit on the back porch railing. She could never catch them there, but their willingness to perch right above her and scream their signature song irritated her, though she hid it well. I never saw her retreat from them, the way she finally abandoned the front porch if the barn swallows dive-bombed her too relentlessly. But she definitely believed that if things in life had really been fair, and she'd only been surer of her hind legs, she would have taught the Phoebes a lesson. This rivalry also provided me with some amusement in the winter months, when Masha seemed very bored and blue. I would play Phoebe songs on my phone. Masha knew not to expect the birds until early spring, and even then only outside. But when I played the songs in the basement with the volume of the phone all the way up, she would snap to it, confused at first, since there was still snow on the ground, and then bound from room to room. It was part teasing, yes, but also a good way to get her low-impact exercise in the listless weeks, at least until she figured it out and the trick no longer interested her. Catnip, which can be used with many cats as an aid in rousing them to some kind of activity, played no such role in Masha's life. Though she did enjoy it. The herb is a sedative, which is the paradoxical reason it can make cats seem so dizzy and crazed. Nearly all of the cat's muscles are of the fast-twitch variety, rousing the clock to spring into action, no matter how lazy and sleepy the cat may be. Catnip can calm many of those muscles, even if only a bit, mimicking the effect of some of their internal chemicals. In other words, by relaxing their muscles and psyche, it frees them up for what sometimes is called the cat crazies. Or, in Masha's case, catnip could be of actual palliative use when her legs were in painful spasms. At such times, she was not a cat who would be satisfied with the ordinary amount of catnip that came in the form of a shiny cloth-wrapped toy or a fake rodent, though I did find one fairly realistic fake chipmunk that could be velcroed open and stuffed with good quantities of fresh herbs, allowing Masha both a few minutes of simulated outdoor hunting indoors and then the joy of ripping her prey open to reveal the catnip within it. Guts. Usually, however, she wanted a big pile of the stuff placed on a small pillow that she loved on the basement floor where she would lie down with her chest and forelegs half buried in it, enjoying the release it afforded her cramped muscles. By now, with over a decade of shared life to our credit, there were very few new spoken phrases or words that could adequately describe my feelings about Masha. So increasingly I took to making up more songs about her. It had always been my custom to sing snatches of known songs, especially jingles and ditties, opera arias, or those idiot popular creations that catch in one's head and which, supposedly, singing along will purge one's mind. But songs about Masha, of which I must have made up 1,000 by now and forgotten 989 of them, were the most fun, because they sometimes flattered and sometimes annoyed her, and also because every so often one time in 100 I could hit on one that she truly liked, and that I could sing to her in sleep. Even at such times, though, I had to be sure of her. Every so often she'd lie there in her cat bed by my desk as I worked and sang, rolling on her side or back and letting me pet her chest. Never the belly, always the chest. With Masha, as with so many cats, because the hairs of their bellies and tails are hypersensitive, and rubbing in those spots too long can often be unpleasant. But on certain occasions, Masha would suddenly, in mid-song, whack me, and what some atrophied as her rear leg muscles were by then, the compensatory muscles of her front half were still hugely strong, so strong that she could jump very decently heights by pushing up and off a launching spot with her front legs alone. I'd hollow and retreat at such moments, like looking at her with what I had hoped was an injured expression. It was likely I'd lost track of time and petted her too much, but it was also possible that, without realizing it, my voice had gone into a register she found irritating. Whatever the case, such attacks would only make me file the song away for future use during those times when I was trying to get her to come inside for the night. Masha's taste in music overall had, by now, gelled. While she would listen to many pieces by the late romantics, they were not resilient or reliant on high-pitched instrumental solos. Saint-Saëns, Danse Macabre, for instance, ultimately baffled her because of its deliberate interplay of such deep orchestrations as she loved, and the kind of wild violin solos that she hated. Her favorites became clear, not only other works by Saint-Saëns, but Mahler particularly as well, as Sibelius and Rachmaninoff. But nothing and no one could ever eclipse her first love, Wagner. And while she luxuriated in pieces like the Liebestrud from Tristan and Isolde, and even enjoyed the deep bass baritone singing of Wotan's Farewell from Dear Valkyrie, nothing, and I'll include catnip in that statement, made her as visibly overjoyed as Prelude from Das Rheingold. No matter where she was, if I began to play the piece loudly enough, she would rush into the downstairs study, dive onto the rug, and, body aches or no, begin to twist as she liked to do on hot days on the porch, but with a deeper look of happiness on her face. The first few times she'd done it, I'd just studied her, fascinated. By the summer of her seniority, I would hear her rocketing my way, and if I was busy typing, declaring, "Thus we begin," which only delighted her more. All this, again, wasn't a question of musical snobbery on Masha's part. Indeed, when I had it explained to me by a well-known musicologist of my acquaintance, I was a bit ashamed of not having figured it out myself. Each of the pieces Masha truly loved remained deep, sonorous themes, seemingly tied into the forest night, as in most cases they were designed to have been by their composers. But the Prelude was the most specifically and effectively targeted of them all along these lines. Not a man who himself liked cats. The musicologist put it to me simply when I told him of Masha's behavior during the Prelude. "Yeah, it's not surprising. That E-flat is about as primal as it gets." And this quality of being primal was the explanation for all the music Masha loved. It also happened to have been the explanation for what drew me to classical music during my childhood. True, I'd become more eclectic in my tastes by the time I met Masha, and whether I lost my liking for lighter pieces because of my own life became less light, or because I was being ever more powerfully touched by Masha's reactions, I really don't know. But my musical inclinations, like my sense of time, were mirroring hers. Such was the ineffable things that bound us, and that, more and more, were prized. The Prelude also had an utilitarian use. On nights when Masha proved reluctant to come inside, at or after sunset, especially in August, I would turn the speakers of the big stereo into the great room to face out at a set of double doors and remind her not only that it was time to come in, but also that there were enjoyable reasons to do so. The rolling waves of the composition undertones would get about halfway to finished, and magically Masha would appear, not looking truculent, as she often did when she was forced to come in, but perked up and ready for an evening of enjoyment, starting with music, treat food, and food in the bowl. It was our healthiest system of compromise, provided I remembered just when to employ it. And on that condition hung the next and greatest crisis of Masha's life. It came not during, but on the eve of the August moon, on a night when my attention was distracted by concern and infuriation. America's two major political parties had been busy in recent days, committing the two greatest errors in their history, nominating at their conventions two candidates who were unfit for reasons of feeble sanity and ignorant arrogance, in the first case, and contemptible lack of integrity, in the second. On the night in question, the second convention was completing its process, with me sitting in the great room and shouting my objections. When I suddenly noticed that it had begun to rain, I jumped up, not wanting the moderately heavy dousing to come into the open double doors of the great room and therefore closing them. I glanced around. Masha was not visible, and because I'd been so wrapped up in my personal outage, I hadn't realized that it was well past her curfew. I figured she was avoiding the dousing by hiding either under the porch or in some other protected spot, and went to have a look. Not a sign. I felt the usual chill at not knowing where she was when it'd been dark for a bit, but I knew that checklist of immediate searches and went about them. First, I did sentry duty on the porch, walking round all the sides of it, bellowing her name in all of its forms, and including and especially those that annoyed her. Then, as I headed down the stairway to nowhere, I sang some of Masha's ditties that could usually be relied upon to make her appear. Still, nothing. So it was back upstairs to reopen a set of the double doors and commence playing Das Rheingold at a volume that would overpower the sound of the steady summer rainfall on the leaves of the maple and ash trees. Still, nothing. Which, together with my burning feet, meant that it was going to get a lot harder to keep anger out of my voice. I began warning her in no uncertain terms that the failure to appear would lead to her being kept inside for a day or two. I hoped maybe that threat would finally carry some weight, because about a year earlier two cats, the drummer and I, had a cookout one very warm summer evening, during which I'd had to open the shed opposite the house to get an axe for wood chopping. I did this carefully, as the shed was a place that fascinated Masha, largely because it contained, at one end, a cord of stacked firewood that was riven with mouse nests. I would have sworn I'd snatched the axe out and gotten the door closed again without Masha getting in, and I sat up broken-hearted all that night when she failed to appear after another extensive search. Only in the early morning did it occur to me that she might somehow have slipped into the shed, even as I tried so hard to make sure that she didn't. Convinced it was a vain exercise, I went outside to check, and sure enough, out of the door she popped, perfectly delighted with herself and the night she had spent in the controlled mouse hunt, to judge by the battlefield state of the shed floor. I was so relieved that I couldn't even scold her. I looked forward to being equally relieved on the rainy night of the political convention. Such was not to be. There was always a rhythm to finding Masha. She was rarely just come when called. I had to yell my lungs out and then wait for 15 or 20 minutes to see if she'd cooperate, or she might come in only when the prelude had finished on the stereo. But on this night I followed each of these routines to no effect. I thought she might be waiting the rain out in some undergrowth, as also sometimes happened, but when it let up, at about 1 in the morning, still no results. I'd already flashed a light up around the trees on the east side of the house, where I'd found her on the night of the bear, but no luck. I hadn't remembered that a steady rain can sometimes make flashlight beams unreliable. So as I heard the rain start to ease off at about 2, I picked up the very big flashlight and headed out on the west side. I wasn't yet exactly terrified for her. There were so many places in which she could have hidden. But I was still unnerved, and using the same plan of moving in the steadily larger circles, I headed farther west, thinking I'd already dealt with the east. I was wrong about the last fact, but it would take me a good half an hour to 45 minutes to discover as much. I slid down hills, getting muddy and soaked. I lost one sneaker in a mass of turf and mud, and I scared up just about every nighttime forest creature I could think of. Just about. I finally went back to the doubt check, the eastern side of the house, and there I found her, in a tree next to the one she'd climbed after the bear fight. But this tree had to have been even harder to get up. It was younger, straighter, its trunk about 8 inches in diameter, and had fewer lower limbs, with smoother bark of the kind that encases maples before they've matured and grown their rough plate scaling. All these facts and more had likely saved Masha's life. She stared down into the flashlight with the same slow, shocked expression, her eyes yellow in the flashlight beam and wincing a little. When I saw that she was alive, as was my heart settled, some of the wind went out of my frustration. "Masha, cat!" I shouted, but more mutedly, as I tried to bring her back to reality and move directly under her. "What in the name of—" And then I stopped suddenly. My feet were less than a yard from the tree's trunk, and at a steady walk, determined but not rushed, a form moved out of the bush and right over them. It was low and long, mammalian. Both of its pace and attitude indicated no fear at all of a human standing and speaking at such close quarters, which was rather bone-chilling in the way that some predators can be. It's not the usual impression, size, a display of threat, that causes it. It's their attitude and their aura. You don't even need to see them clearly to know that you're in the presence of malevolence. As the thing left the undergrowth and headed out to the short grass between the trees and the stream, I tried to catch it in the direct center beam of the flashlight. I couldn't. Maybe I was too rattled, or maybe I just didn't want to see in a clear light what I'd already perceived in the dim outer edges of the beam. The animal was about 4 feet long, from snout to tip of the tail. The appendage was lengthy and heavy. It was a furry thing, and it moved out onto the open lawn, making for the stream bed. I saw the pointed snout and the two rounded ears of its head, which it was shaking just a bit, perhaps to remove rainwater. It wasn't walking in a crouch. Its legs were simply short, as you find on a mink, or an otter, or a fisher. It made sense, being one of the only animals of its size that will behave so boldly in the presence of humans. It was also a bit terrifying. Caught under the tree like that, it might well have spun on me and bitten me. It wasn't desperate for food, plainly, and so was likely on the hunt for the fun of it. Fishers are notorious for such behavior, and house cats are among their favorite prey. And so a confirmed demon had come out to our hollow this time, but was in now leaving because of me? Or just on a whim? Or was it because its face, the face that it was shaking, had been, like the bear's, bloodied beyond the worth of the final prize? And above all, what had it done to Masha? Next week, we'll read Chapter 24, Striking a Bargain, trying to learn just what exactly this fisher did to Masha in the book My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, by Caleb Carr. Our next reading comes from Best Friends, the magazine, November-December 2024. It is the magazine of Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, located in Kanab, Utah. Once abandoned, now adored. After 17 ill cats and kittens were left outside a Utah shelter, the race was on to save their lives. A box of kittens on your doorstep may sound like a dream, but to staff at the shelter already flooded with orphaned kittens, it's quite the opposite. The staff at West Valley City Animal Shelter in Utah found 17 felines, 2 cats, and 15 kittens, to be exact, inside a single pet carrier left outside the shelter. To make matters worse, all of them had upper respiratory infections. Recognizing the urgency of the situation, the West Valley City Animal Shelter worked with Best Friends to bring the kittens to the life-saving center in Salt Lake City. There, Best Friends veterinarian Dr. Megan McCarthy and the rest of the veterinary team started treating the precious patients right away. Some of the kittens had such severe eye infections that one or both eyes needed to be removed. The eye infections that some of these kittens had were the most extreme I'd ever seen, said Roxanne Conowich, Best Friends life-saving and care supervisor. Despite the condition they were in, the kittens were curious, friendly, and playful. Just hours after the arrival, they were wrestling and tumbling around the enclosures. Not all afraid of people, they purred loudly and leaned into each other for scratches. The cats and kittens still need a lot of care to get healthy. One kitten didn't survive, and a little buff and white kitten named Santana was among the sickest in the bunch. Both of her eyes had to be removed, Roxanne says. Chances are she already couldn't see at that point and was in a great amount of pain. Yet Santana and her brothers played and cuddled and ate like nothing bad had ever happened to them. With good care, the once-abandoned felines began to look and feel better. Then one by one they were adopted, including Santana. Her young life had nearly ended, but instead it is just beginning. This life-saving story comes from Best Friends, the November-December 2024 edition of the magazine of the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, located in Kanab, Utah. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of the readings for today on Animal Companions. I do hope you enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Sun Sounds of Arizona and for Animal Companions. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.